Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders Podcast. I'm the host, Brady Huggett, and the guest for this show is Rachel King. She's the CEO and president of GlycoMimetics, and until very recently was the chairwoman of BIO, the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. They just changed her name. It used to be Biotechnology Industry Organization. The acronym stays the same, BIO. Anyway, Rachel was in New York, and I brought her into the studio, and we talked about gene therapy. One of the companies that Rachel worked at early in her career was a gene therapy company. We talked about postponing an IPO, something that she has experience with. And we talked about Dartmouth, how and why she chose Dartmouth as her undergraduate school. This is the last First Rounders podcast to be recorded in the studio. When we took over this lease, there actually was not a space for podcast recordings, audio recording at all, video recording. And we made one. And I say we, but I had nothing to do with it. We looks like we found a utility closet, cut some pipes out of it, strung black styrofoam soundproofing on all the walls. And, you know, when you're closed in here, it gives pretty good audio. But it always felt like it is a grim black space. And I would bring these guests in it. You know, I wasn't sure if I was doing an interview or some sort of, you know, police interrogation. So anyway, that's the last one of these. The next one that I do in studio will be at our new location, which is at the southern tip of Manhattan. So Rachel King is the final First Rounders podcast from this studio. Enjoy. Did you grow up in New England?
Well, I was born in Boston, and my family moved to New Jersey briefly, and then to Ohio for about 10 years until I was in ninth grade, then back to New Jersey. So moved around a bit.
So how did you end up going to, I mean, just Dartmouth because it's a good school?
You know, when I was applying to colleges, I visited colleges, and it's funny the way you make these decisions. I actually visited Dartmouth right before homecoming weekend, and it was actually the Thursday before homecoming, and there was a tradition at Dartmouth where they would build a big bonfire, and part of the tradition also is that the upperclassmen try to burn it down, which they almost never do, but they actually had that year. So they'd burned it down in advance of homecoming weekend. The freshmen build the bonfire.
Rite of passage. Freshmen have to do it.
Freshmen have to build it. The upperclassmen sort of try to burn it down or paint their numbers on it, and the freshmen sleep there to protect it. You know? But that particular year, the upperclassmen had actually burnt it down before homecoming weekend. And so I arrived on Thursday, and the whole campus was there trying to build it back up. And so,
including those same seniors who burned it down.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was out there. The band was there playing, you know, pep songs from the green, and the radio station had a mobile unit reporting progress from the green on building the bonfire. And there was so much, you know, energy and excitement around it. I thought, wow, this would be a really fun place to go to college. So I applied early decision, actually, and never looked back.
So correct me if I'm wrong. Do they still do that?
They do still build a bonfire, yep.
Someplace there was a huge bonfire at a university and it tumbled and hurt some kids.
Yes, it was a tragedy, actually. I think it was one of the Texas universities.
Okay. They still do it at Dartmouth then.
They do still do it at Dartmouth, yeah.
Going into Dartmouth, had you thought about what your career was going to be in any serious way? I mean, I think we all sort of have ideas when we apply, but Sometimes it doesn't stick.
Actually, I had thought I would probably go into the sciences and in particular wanted to go to medical school, I thought, when I started college. I had been really interested in biology when I was growing up. I mean, biology or you know, nature, you know,
right.
being in nature.
Right.
And I had a dissecting kit at home and a microscope at home and was just a kind of a biology geek. And I took AP Bio in high school, and it's actually still one of my favorite classes ever. And then when I got to Dartmouth, I thought I was going to be pre-med, and the subject I liked the least was math. And so I thought I would take calculus first and get it out of the way.
Uh-huh.
And I got a C freshman fall, and I thought, I guess I'm not smart enough to do this.
Uh-huh.
And I just got discouraged and went in a completely different direction. So
business.
Yes. So I majored in French and political science or government. And eventually I went to business school. And luckily, over time, realized that I could combine that interest in biology, which I've still always had, with business. And so luckily ended up, you know, working in biotechnology.
You graduated from Dartmouth with a major in French?
Yes.
And political science?
Yes, correct.
And then did you look for work and realize that it's difficult to get a job if you majored in French, or did you go right to the MBA?
Well, I went to Bain.
Yeah.
Consulting
in between?
Firm. Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
after
that.
After college, yeah. And that was great experience. And actually, in those days, Harvard Business School had a deferred admit program, so you could apply out of college and then defer for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I had been accepted and knew that I would have 2 years to work. And Bain in those days hired a lot of people who had that in that situation. And so, but while I was at Bain, it was, you know, great exposure to business. And luckily, I was assigned to a case team that was working for one of the early biotechnology companies.
Which one?
And it was Genetics Institute that was working with Baxter at the time.
Huh.
And so I worked on that project, and it kind of opened my eyes to this aspect of business that I really hadn't been so much aware of.
You
then.
Can combine those two interests then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then went to business school. Then actually after business school, my husband and I got married, and we went to China for a year. I had studied Chinese in college. I've always loved languages, not just French. and so we lived in China in Xi'an in 85-86, and then came back to the States. He was at Stanford Business School then, and I got a job, my first biotech job in Palo Alto working for Alza.
Alza, right. Okay, so I'm going to back you up a little bit.
Yeah.
The move to Ohio, mm-hmm. was that for some your parents' career or something?
Yeah, my father's work.
What was his? What did he do?
He worked for Merrill Lynch, and he was in their regional offices and was transferred to Cleveland. Well, first to Akron, then to Cleveland, and then back to Manhattan, which is why we then moved to New Jersey when I was in high school.
Oh, so he worked in the city, and you guys lived in Jersey.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. What did you think of Ohio?
Oh, I love it. I have wonderful memories of being in Ohio. You know, it was we lived in the country, and We had animals. I mean, I earned my allowance by selling eggs. We had chickens, and my father had the scheme that it would be good to basically have to buy the feed out of my revenue and learn the concept of profit. so the
right.
allowance was the profit
yeah.
from the egg business. But it was and we had chores, you know, before and after school. But I loved living in Ohio. It was
great
memories.
So your father worked at Merrill Lynch, okay?
Yeah.
He was not a farmer, but
correct.
He wanted to instill in you this understanding of what that is like. So you had chickens because it was sort of you know, a way of life that you wanted to experience, and other farm animals?
We had horses, and my father raised hunting dogs, and at one point had a goat. But it wasn't a working farm.
Yeah.
It was more kind of in the woods in the country, kind of between Akron and Cleveland.
Did your father grown up on a farm or something?
He had grown up in upstate New York, and he and my mother both really liked that life. I mean, yeah, not a working farm, but in the country.
Yeah. No, it's...
But still, it's a lot of work. I mean, I always
course.
Think when people talk about the idyllic country life, I think, yeah, and it's a lot of work.
It is. It's idyllic if you're not doing anything. If
yeah.
you actually have to run it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Alza.
Yes.
That's Alejandro Zaffaroni company.
Yes, correct.
Did you know him?
I met him. You know, I was very, you know, not a not a He didn't have a lot to do at that time with the running of ALSA.
Yeah.
And so he occasionally came around. So I had an opportunity to meet him, but didn't really interact much with him.
Yeah, and that company, you were there until it was bought by J&J, I think.
No, it was before the company was bought by J&J. And you know, some years later, that happened.
You are fresh out of Harvard. Mm-hmm. They hire you to do what?
Well, my job there, first job there, was called Manager of Corporate Issues, which was a very kind of ambiguous job title. I think deliberately so. I reported to a man, Peter Carpenter, who had responsibility for kind of an unusual basket of things, including strategy and kind of special projects. And so I think that it wasn't really clear what the job was going to exactly involve, and it involved some of a lot of things. But that was the first position there, and then I became director of R&D administration, which was kind of like the sort of the project management associated with, you know, coordinating the various functions for projects that were partnered with the suppliers of the drug. It was a drug delivery company, so they did a lot of partnerships on the sort of drug and drug delivery device combinations.
And then you went to genetic therapy?
Genetic therapy, that's right.
So how did that happen?
Well, I had really – so we were – my husband finished up at business school, and we decided to move back east. We wanted to be closer to our families. Uh-huh. Our first child was born out there. And we actually tried to get jobs in Pittsburgh, among other places, mm-hmm. because we thought that would be great quality of life. But we ended up both getting offers outside of Washington. And I had really gotten – I have kind of for a long time had sort of the entrepreneurial bug, as it were, and also really liked being in the biotechnology industry. So I was actively looking for early stage or even startup biotech companies that I could join. And I met Jim Barrett, who had recently founded Genetic Therapy. There were about maybe 10 or 12 people there mm-hmm. When I went to interview. And it was interesting. It was before gene transfer had been done in humans, and they were setting out to try to be, you know, the first company that would get permission to do that. And it was just very much the startup phase. I mean, Jim said when he interviewed me, I think he wanted to be clear. I really set my expectations. He said, you know, I just want you to know that you might come to work someday, and the roof might be leaking. And that might be your problem. And I said, fine, you know, I'll do it. Sign me up. You know,
so, but they were hiring you as a project manager again.
Well, the job that case was called manager of laboratory operations.
So you would sort of oversee the labs.
Well, so it was an ambiguous job definition when I first got there. I did some accounting work. I placed orders. So these kids who just came out of college were working as research associates, and they gave me their order sheet. This is before you did it on computer. So I personally called up Fisher Scientific, and I said, you know, we need two boxes of this stock number. Can we please have it by Tuesday? And I did things like, I mean, one of the low points, I will admit, when I was organizing the library. So it was, again, before everything was online, and we said to all the scientists, bring in all the old journals that you have, and they just brought them in and dumped them in a room, and I personally put them in order on the shelves and then sent around the notes saying, you know, does anyone have May, you know, 1985 or whatever. But I also got to meet the venture capitalists. I got to be in all the management meetings. You know, eventually that led to licensing, where I took responsibility for, you know, we were developing vector systems, but we weren't discovering genes, so we needed to in-license the genes. One thing basically led to another, an expansion of opportunities in a lot of different ways. And eventually, you know, after the company was sold to Novartis, Jim left and they named me the CEO. So over the 10 years, I'd had a lot of different experiences
there.
Okay,
so both of those early jobs, it almost sounds like they were creating a position for you. It's not like you saw an ad and they said, what mm-hmm. we need is this person, and you applied. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you said, I want to work there. And they said, well, you know, we can build a position that you'll be sort of doing this and a little bit of that.
Well, I think that's sort of true. I mean, I did really want to work in those companies that I, you know, did make the case and was willing to take a job that was poorly defined and
just to get in there.
Yeah, and so I think you know, because I didn't have that science degree, right? Uh-huh. So I needed to kind of find a way, maybe not a a typical way to sort of get in, and to be willing to be sort of a jack of all trades, and to really be willing to do things like organize the library, and so yes, luckily I met people who were receptive to my enthusiasm.
Your tenacity.
Yeah.
Right. So 10 years at Genetic Therapy, the IPO happens in that time frame,
yes.
Right? And then Novartis. I mean, those are both really large events in a company's history,
yeah.
And you saw both of them.
Yes.
What did you take away from that? You were not CEO when the IPO happened.
Correct.
Right?
I ended up doing a lot of different things. I had a number of different roles at Genetic Therapy from which I observed and participated in these milestones. And I will say at one point I remember thinking to myself, I've done a little bit of a lot of things, and kind of lamenting that I didn't have maybe, really deep functional experience in one area. I think, as it turns out, that is actually really good training to start a company, to have had experience in a lot of different areas. But it was, that was such an interesting experience overall from a lot of different perspectives. And I reflect back on it now when I think about the progress that's been made in the gene therapy field. Still no approvals in the United States, but, but perhaps on the cusp, now some 25 years after the first patient was treated.
Right.
So there was a lot of excitement, and we did the first approved human gene therapy experiment in the United States at the NIH, first a gene marker experiment and then a gene therapy experiment in patients with ADA deficiency. That was a milestone in many ways, and really exciting to be part of. The IPO was exciting too. That was at another time when there were a lot of companies that were able to get public. It's remarkable. I think the GTI IPO raised something like $13 million. It was not a lot of money in the scheme of IPOs today, but same amount of work. I mean, we had to do the S-1, go on the roadshow, and all that, and so it was momentous for the company. And we did I think 3 or 4 follow-ons before the company was bought by Novartis. So to live to see that, and to see the broadening clinical trials that were then done, not only by us but by others as well, in the gene therapy area, was also really interesting. Then Novartis came in. Initially, we had a partnership with Sandoz, which was on a brain tumor product, kind of a complicated, interesting product. It was actually retroviral vector producer cells that were implanted into the brain of a patient after the tumor was resected. And the producer cells, live cells, would generate vector that contained the gene for thymidine kinase, which then could be killed after the patients were given. Any cell that took that up would then be killed with ganciclovir, which was given after the surgery. So it was kind of a complicated but very sophisticated biological attempt to treat glioblastoma, which failed. But we partnered that with Sandoz, and through that partnership, Sandoz got to know the company, and then eventually it was actually Sandoz that acquired GTI and then very quickly merged with Ciba. So then we became a subsidiary of Novartis.
Okay. I was wondering how that purchase came about.
No, I think it was, for many years, it was one of the only companies that made money for investors in the gene therapy space.
Yeah.
I mean, now, of course, there are more.
Plenty, right.
But it was, it was, I think, considered a very successful transaction. And an interesting opportunity. I think we all thought that it was going to be more straightforward to develop genetic therapies than it has turned out to be. And particularly, I think we all thought that for single gene defects, like hemophilia or cystic fibrosis, it would be easier than it proved to be. And we also thought there were going to be a lot of opportunities in oncology, particularly in what at the time was the early attempts at immunotherapy, none of which panned out as quickly as everybody had hoped. So we thought that to be part of a major pharma company, I think, would be beneficial to both. But still has not.
Well, it never does, right? That's the thing we can learn after watching biotech industry for however long. It always takes longer than you think it's going.
Oh, and I think, there had to be initial steps, right? I mean, and I think as a field, collectively we had to learn things about about vector development, about gene transfer, you know, more sophistication around the biology in general and the delivery technology. So I think, you know, the field had to go through its early days, right? And it's certainly really exciting for me now to see it continuing to advance and hopefully towards some approvals.
Yeah. So after the acquisition, you stayed on. You ran the subsidiary?
Yes. So then Jim Barrett left, and he was the founder. Shortly after the acquisition. And then I had actually been, before the acquisition, I was vice president for product planning, which meant that I was working closely with the team from Novartis on the implementation of that brain tumor study. So I got to have a lot of exposure to the Sandoz and then the Novartis Development Organization, and so knew the people, and it was, a natural progression to then run GTI as a subsidiary of Novartis. It was a challenging transition, I think. You know, they always are, in my experience and in what I've heard, that as much as, you know, the acquirer and the company being acquired, you know, you come with your goals for what it's going to look like after the acquisition happens. But I think they're always challenging to implement. And in that case, you know, we had been a management team running an independent publicly held company on our own. And I think it was very challenging for a lot of us to then realize that we had, you know, a lot of people we had to answer to. We needed approvals for things that we had not needed approvals for in the past. And we had to figure out a whole new system for getting things done. And so over time, most of the other members of the management team left. And I did stay. And I think it turned out to be a great opportunity for me also to then learn, you know, what it's like to be part of a larger organization. So, you know, I'm grateful for that experience too. I eventually left GTI when Novartis made a decision to consolidate GTI with the operations of GTI with the operations of a company called Systemix, which they had acquired on the West Coast. They were an early stem cell company. Technology out of Stanford, and they also had some gene therapy work. And so the work that was being done at that time was complementary. I think it made sense for them to be consolidated. But unfortunately, it led to me also being in a position of having to lay off about a third of our workforce at Genetic Therapy. We had about maybe 200 and some people at the time, so we had to lay off about 75 people all at once, which was extremely challenging. Difficult.
So how did you do that? Well, let's back up a little bit. When mergers like this happen, the one that's being acquired, often, I mean, morale really sags. Did you find that was the case for the employees at GTI?
I wouldn't say that morale sagged, although, I mean, everybody could speak to that from their own perspective. I think first people get anxious, right, because we wonder about the changes. In the short term, you know, actually, Novartis continued to invest in GTI, and in fact, to the point of building a beautiful new building, you know, for our research activities, and really, you know, continuing to grow our activities. Uh-huh. And so that was exciting, I think, for people. There was also, on the other hand, I think some people would have said there was a new reporting burden because we did have more frequent reporting. And to people not on site. So the communication was more challenging compared to being in a small company. And so, you know, we all had to kind of work it through. A number of people from GTI eventually moved into Novartis, into the research facility that was then built at Cambridge in Boston. And so I think people had some good opportunities. However, in the fairly near term, eventually they shut the whole thing down. So there's that site was entirely closed, as I believe was the Systemix site eventually.
So they named you CEO.
Yes.
And then how soon after that were they like, you now need to go lay off 75 workers?
Oh, it was about 2 years.
Yeah. So how did you manage that as, you know, the CEO? How did you, that's, I assume your first experience doing that.
Yes. And it was very difficult. First of all, there was the period of trying to convince Novartis not to do it, you know, and that went on for months. And
how so?
There was the decision to consolidate the operations between what was going on at GTI and Systemix, and so we needed to figure out how to do that. And you know, I felt that we should be consolidated at our site in Gaithersburg. The people at Systemics wanted it to be consolidated out in California. And so, you know, in that whole, you know, work up to the final decision, which was that most of the development functions were going to be consolidated in Palo Alto. We would continue just research in Maryland. Up until that point, there was a lot of, you know, trying to make the case, which I was not successful in trying to get the development located in Maryland. Then, actually, it was a really interesting experience to go through the layoff itself because, you know, I mean, I had been there for 10 years. I knew the people, and some of them quite well. And, you know, the normal way that a lot of layoffs were done, and I think maybe still are done, is that, you know, some people recommend you bring the people who are going to be laid off into a room and you tell them that day.
One-on-one.
Well, or some people even say I've even heard people doing it as a group when there's a big layoff and then people get till, you know, noon to empty out their desk and then they're gone. And I really did not want to do that. And I do remember having to really make this case to the people at Novartis, which they did eventually agree to, that I wanted to do it in a way that I thought was more respectful and really reflected the fact that, you know, people had been dedicated and putting their lives to it. And I think a lot of times people think there's a risk that, you know, people are going to, our employees are going to abscond with something
or
they're
going to
sabotage or something. And I thought, well, you know, I really felt that was a low risk. Anyway, so what we did was as soon as I knew that the decision was made that we were going to consolidate with and move functions, I had a company meeting and I said, this decision has been made. The following groups here are the most likely to be affected. We don't have a detailed plan yet, but we're working on that. We expect to have that in this time frame. It is going to result in a layoff. When we know that the layoff is going to happen, you know, we'll set a date for that, and I will tell you in advance what the date is so everybody will know whatever the date is going to be, layoff day. And, you know, we'll communicate as this process unfolds. And I think people appreciated knowing that. You know, there was uncertainty anyway. People knew that there was, some possibility of
consolidation. But what that meeting does, it sort of, that already throws a flag up.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can start to begin to at least mentally prepare that it might be them.
Yeah.
Right? They better get their resume
yes.
in shape. And then when the actual word comes down, it is going to be you and you have, I don't know, 6 weeks, however long.
Yeah.
They're a little more prepared. So
yeah, that people would be more prepared and that people would be, you know, treated with more respect and it would be more, you know, we had formed kind of a community, I think, at the company, and that the community together would kind of be going through this. Because I also think, and I do believe this very strongly, that when you have a big layoff like that, the people who stay pay a lot of attention to how the people who leave get treated.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's, you know, you can't think to yourself as a manager that you're going to treat some people one way and then you're going to treat other people the other way.
And they won't
know. And that you can tell people we're going to say one group you're going to lay you off and tell the other group, you know, we love you so much that they're not going to feel the love, you know.
Right.
So I really, you know, went through that. It was very challenging. But I think in the end people did appreciate it. And there was no, you know, we had no sabotage or any kind of negative events. And
So you actually do the one-on-one when it came time?
Well, then when it came time to, so then we ended up, so we set a date. I can't remember what day it actually was. We said, okay, next Tuesday is layoff day. And then we did have people meet individually with their supervisor, or if the supervisor was being laid off, they met with the relevant vice president and one-on-one had the individual communications, yeah.
Okay, so then you were still there.
Well, actually, I also lost my job.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes, because it turned out that there wasn't a need for a CEO function at Genetic Therapy anymore. It was more of a research organization.
Right.
I did have I had become very interested in the interface between complicated science and the public, and actually, gene therapy turned out to be a really good example mm-hmm. of how you need the public support even though the public doesn't understand really what you're talking about a lot of the time, because there was a tragic event at University of Pennsylvania where a patient died in a gene therapy protocol. Jesse Gelsinger.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And anyway, I had become very interested in that kind of communication issue, and Novartis gave me the chance to run their Washington office and corporate communications for the U.S., so kind of the outside.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Base of Novartis. So, so I was given an opportunity to move into that role, knowing that I'd be leaving GTI. There really wasn't a role of a CEO-type person there.
So how was that, the new position?
You know, it was really interesting. I was not such a political junkie. You know, a lot of people who run Washington offices are really political junkies.
Yeah.
And so maybe to be a little bit politically naive actually was kind of a good thing in some ways, because I came in with a lot of enthusiasm. And I felt like the, you know, there were times when I felt like I just couldn't believe that I was getting paid to talk to interesting people about things that I thought were really important. And there were a lot of times when I felt like that was what my job was, and lobbying really is that,
yeah,
in its best form,
right.
And the portfolio that Novartis had at that time was also really interesting. We had gene therapy, cell therapy, xenotransplantation, agricultural biotechnology, SIBA vision, Gerber baby food, pharmaceuticals. So it was quite a, you know, diverse portfolio of things. And so it was interesting. And I think actually it turns out great background for my role now as board chair at Bio.
Yeah, okay.
Because I really came to appreciate the possible impact. I appreciate the difference that policy really makes. So coming into it, it was very interesting. I enjoyed it. I did it for 2.5 years, and then I realized, you know, that was enough. I wanted to be back in a small company environment, and so that was when I left and then went to NEA.
Okay, so, but who, when you say you were addressing the public, who?
Well, so I guess when I say that the public, I mean I was interested in the general issue of needing to get public support for difficult and complex scientific innovation that we were doing in biotechnology. My specific role in running the Washington office was more engaging with policymakers.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So NEA,
mm-hmm.
They had been an investor in genetic therapy,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
So you already had some relationship with them?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so is this where you went in and then you said, I want to work for you, and they formed a position for you and hired you?
Well, so I went to Chuck Newhall, who was one of the founders of NEA, and he had been on our board at genetic therapy. And genetic therapy was one of the first NEA investments back when NEA was small,
uh-huh,
you know, before they got to be the huge megalith that they are now. And so I went to Chuck, and they had – so NEA had continued to basically do both tech and biotech investing, which was unusual because it takes such different skills to do each of those well. And the tech bubble had burst, and NEA had just raised their first $1 billion fund, which was going to, and they were going to increase their biotech investments. And I went to Chuck actually asking if he could give me leads on companies that I could go into, an NEA company. And he basically said, well, I don't have any companies right now per se, but maybe you could come and be an entrepreneur in residence. And he said, we've actually just hired a new general partner for our big fund, and if you could convince that person that you could work well together, then maybe you could work with him and help us do diligence on deals for that new fund and work up a project that might be a company that you could run. And I said, sure, who is it? And he said, it's Jim Barrett. And I said,
no problem.
Great. You know, I'll see if I can talk him into it. And so so again, and I think, you know, one thing I see when I look back on my career is I do find myself attracted to situations where there's a lot of ambiguity in what the job actually is going to require. And I mean, that's true in almost every job I've had.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's because, I don't know, I could see it being attractive because then you don't, it seems like the sky's the limit. I'm going to do all these interesting things versus, you know, when you come in, you're going to do this every single day. Do you think that's it?
I think it's, I do feel like I have what I might describe as an entrepreneurial bent, meaning, and I think by that I mean that I like to do things that are new that maybe haven't been done before, haven't been done quite in the way that I might want to do them. Mm-hmm. And I also think that it may be that I'm attracted to situations of high ambiguity because I like to plan. So, you know, I'd like to develop plans and structures around things, but also, you know, do things that are really innovative and new. So anyway, so I did go to NEA, and that was another great opportunity. Although it's funny, you know, people, I've had a lot of people say to me in the years since then, and when I was still there, boy, I want to be an entrepreneur in residence too. And I said it was fabulous, absolutely fabulous opportunity. To be on the inside of a fund like NEA, which has such talented people, you know, they get incredible deal flow. It was great to, you know, to spend some time kind of under that, kind of in the shadow of this great venture fund. And I was on a really short leash. You know, I ended up being there for, I guess, almost a year and a half by the time we funded GlycoMimetics. But I had a 3-month contract. I was not paid a lot of money to do it. And by the end of it, I was on a month-to-month contract. You know, so yeah, there's no, I'm telling people, there's no job stability there. You know,
but by your decision or
no,
theirs?
No, by NEA's decision. Okay. I mean, NEA, I don't know how they have done it with other EIRs, but, you know, it was a short-term thing that was extended through the eventual financing of GlycoMimetics, but fabulous, just incredible opportunity for which I'm really, really grateful. But I think some people looking at the outside might think it's more of a stable long-term arrangement. But, you know, in their opportunity to try to make something of it, and then, you know, you got to be out.
So that you saw GlycoMimetics and thought that's the one, and you started building it as part of NEA?
Well, so what I did, you know, I was working with Jim Barrett, right, doing diligence on deals that NEA was looking at. And I was looking for what might be my deal,
right,
you know, a deal that would come in that needed a CEO. And I was also out looking for interesting technology that I might build a deal around. Mm-hmm. In that context, I was introduced to John Mignani, who is now our chief scientific officer at GlycoMimetics. And he had been running a company called GlycoTech himself. He'd run it for 10 years. And he had run it through basically a reagents business, some grant funding, and through a research collaboration with Siba Geigy, mm-hmm, and had kept it all going. But he had gotten to the point where he realized he wanted to take it to another level and really try to develop drugs out of the technology. I became really converted to thinking about the carbohydrate space as being one that had a lot of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so together, he and I put together a business plan, which NEA backed, and we were able to get some other investors that came in early on as well.
So then you were down with the EIR position.
Yep.
Just an EA.
Okay. Yeah.
So let's, two things I want to talk about, and then we can sort of broaden this. One is, I'm not sure when you began your association with Bio. It was for emerging companies first, right?
Yes. So my first involvement with Bio, which was brief, was when I was at Genetic Therapy, and I was briefly on the board as the Novartis representative, as in my role as CEO of GTI. Then came off. Went back in after we founded Glycomimetics, and I was on the Emerging Companies board, then was eventually vice chair of that and then chair of Emerging Companies section.
And did you go to them, or did they come to you?
When I originally went back on, I went to them, and then it was Steve Sherwin, who was going to become chair of Emerging Companies, who asked me if I would be his vice chair.
Okay, so when you went to them, I mean, did you feel you didn't have enough to do running Glycomimetics that you now wanted to do this as well?
Well, I had really enjoyed being involved with Bio, even though it was briefly through my associate at GTI.
Yeah.
I wanted to be involved. I mean, I think it's important what Bio does. I had become convinced, as I mentioned, when I was doing the Novartis Washington office work, that, you know, policy matters. And incentives matter, and so I thought it was important, and it's also a great way to network with other people in the biotech community. So I've always loved that aspect of Bio. You know, I look forward to the meetings.
Yeah.
To be with the people that are also on the board. It's a great community to be a part of. So I wanted to be part of it again.
Okay. And so then Glycomimetics. You can correct me where I'm wrong here. You have a phase 2 drug, vaso-occlusive crisis.
Correct.
It's partnered, I think, with Pfizer.
Yes, correct.
And then you have a phase 1 for leukemia.
Correct.
And maybe preclinical for undecided cancers yet.
Yes,
something like that.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take me through building this company from the ground up, what that's been like.
Well, it's been really hard to finance, I'll tell you that. We had, when we decided, and it's interesting now because orphan diseases are hot and sickle cell disease is hot, but when we had a technology around the selectins, right, which is a family of adhesion molecules. Mm-hmm. And when we first started trying to raise money around that, some investors said, oh, we've seen this before. This has already been tried and failed. It's not a good target. There were some companies, Cytel and Glycomed, maybe it's been 15, maybe even 20 years ago now, that had tried and failed with other approaches to successfully target the selectins and deliver some kind of meaningful clinical data. So the first rap was, oh, those aren't good targets. Another concern was that carbohydrate chemistry is complicated, and it is complex, but some investors said, oh, it's you know, too complicated. And then when we had some challenges around our technology. When we decided to apply the technology to sickle cell disease, then we had a lot of people tell us that, you know, sickle cell disease is too complicated an indication to go after. It's heterogeneous patient population. And there is complexity. There is heterogeneity. I acknowledge that. But we were really discouraged from going into sickle cell disease. Another thing which people said, and this proved very important and interesting when we got to our final phase 2, our eventual phase 2 readout, a number of investors said to us, sickle cell patients are, a lot of them, drug addicts because they take so much narcotics that you're never going to be able to tease out your effect against a background of drug addiction.
I've never heard that.
Well, sickle cell patients, I think, a lot of times are stigmatized, and I think this is true. They're stigmatized because they come into the hospital emergency rooms. Most of them African Americans, and the only relief that they can get now is with narcotics. So they come in asking for narcotics because of the intense pain, the debilitating pain that they suffer in these crises, and so it's true that even some in the medical community stigmatize them. So one of the things that we saw in our phase 2 study actually. Was that in a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled study where patients controlled the use of their own narcotics, we had an 83% reduction in narcotic use when patients were getting our drug that was statistically significant, even in a very small study, which vindicates the patients, actually, that they're not, you know, in that study, you could see that's not the behavior of people who are using drug addictively,
right? That's right. They're using it to control their pain.
But anyway, but that was one of the challenges in fundraising. So it was challenging to go after that, but we felt that was it was an unmet need where we felt the biological target was highly relevant, where we also thought that if we were successful, the therapy could be transformative, and so that was what we had chosen. But there were a lot of challenges around that. Another challenge was, you know, when we raised our Series C, which was an important fund for us, because we also brought Genzyme Ventures into that round, because they liked the sickle cell program. So we got some validation from someone who really understood the rare disease space in that. And we raised that fund thinking that we would be able to use that money to complete the phase two study, which took longer than we had hoped. And so we were faced with the problem of basically running out of money before the study was done. And so, you know, on one hand, we could have basically, you know, laid off practically everybody but a skeleton crew to just try to get that study done, or try to partner it in order to bring in funding so that we could keep some other programs advancing. And we decided to do the latter. And by that time, orphan diseases had gotten hot. We had multiple companies that were interested in it. Sickle cell made a lot of sense to people. So we ended up getting multiple term sheets for that deal, but did the deal with Pfizer. And they've been a good partner for us. So lots of challenges along the way. But there's been a lot of challenges. Actually, another challenge I should probably talk about in that on that subject is the challenge of getting a company public. Because we actually went out the first time to try to get public, and we're not successful in doing that. We went out, so we got our phase two data in the spring of 2013, and it was heating up to be a really good year for biotech IPOs.
Yep.
But we couldn't actually go public unless we knew that Pfizer was going to take it forward. We were talking to bankers, and they said, you know, data's great, but we need to have a Pfizer commitment. So we got the Pfizer commitment in, I think, June, and then in July, right after the 4th of July, we did the org meeting to try to start drafting documents. And we were racing to get the company public in that fall. But the other issue that we had was, you know, we wanted to submit the data to ASH, so we needed to preserve the fact that it would be new at ASH at the same time that we needed to put top-line data in the S-1 so that investors would know what they were getting, right? So we put top-line data in the S-1. We heard from investors during the roadshow that they really wanted to see the abstracts. We expected that, the public abstracts. So we basically timed the roadshow so that we would be pricing a day or two after the abstracts came out, which was in November. And so we went on the roadshow and started off great. But as we kept going, you know, we started seeing that the biotech index was actually trading down for the first time that year.
Yeah.
And we were starting to hear from investors that there was more, or from our bankers, that the investors were putting more price pressure on deals. And then we started to hear people are, quote, putting their pencils down, which was a very bad thing.
Yeah. What time of the year is this?
This was November of 2013.
Right.
And so we finished the roadshow, and then we met with the bankers at the very end of it in New York. And I remember we were there with our whole team, and they asked if the CFO and I could please come into the other room privately and talk to them, which is not a good sign. And so we went in there, and they told us, you know, we just can't put the book together. And so we had to postpone. And we were the first of, I think, seven or eight companies that ended up postponing at the end of that year.
I remember that, yeah. I mean, there's usually a slowdown at the end of the year anyway, right?
Yep.
I mean, people begin to sit on their gains for the year. So what happened in 2014? Have you addressed this?
So that was November. Then ASH happened, and we presented our data, and it was chosen as best of ASH that year, which I'm so proud of.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's thousands of things going on at ASH, and and they choose a very small number to be highlighted as best of ASH. So we were really pleased with that. We also had an end of phase two meeting with the FDA that helped to give some visibility into what was planned for phase three. Mm-hmm. And so, and I knew that everybody was going to be teeing up their IPOs at JP Morgan.
Right.
And so I said to the bankers, we really, really want to see if we could do this before JP Morgan. And their initial reaction was,
that's
going to be really hard.
It's in
hard.
Between, you know, the start of the year and,
yeah.
you know, 10 days in or whatever.
Exactly. And so so they said, well, you know, if everything were to line up perfectly, it could happen. But, you know, we need to get an anchor order. We need to, you know, get around, update everybody in the meantime. And, you know, it's going to be hard. So I actually personally took the list of people we'd gone to on the road trip, personally called them up, and we set up calls then during December, so a lot of them over the holidays with our management team and with these, you know, investors that we thought we were just trying to generate interest with. And then the bankers were following up to, you know, to see would anybody step up as an anchor order, and we did. So then we went to work on that first Monday after New Year's with our bags, not knowing if we would go to New York that afternoon or not. And we did a call around noon, and the banker said, yep, actually, we got an anchor order. We can do the deal. So went to New York. We did two more days of marketing, and we closed before JP Morgan.
You did.
So it was
that's
the first.
Amazing.
That's how it got to be the first IPO of
the year.
2014. So
yeah.
We actually have a big sign in our lobby. NASDAQ put a big thing up on their marquee saying, you know, NASDAQ welcomes GlycoMedix, the first IPO of 2014, which was very cool.
That's nice, yeah.
But, you know, so we have it up there, and, you know, sometimes people, you know, visitors come and admire it, and I say to myself, you have no idea what that took.
Don't recommend doing it the way that we did it.
Yeah. So, but I think, that, you know, it's rare, and I think, too, you know, I've made this point in a couple of talks I've given. You know, if you look at sort of the outside story of a lot of biotechnology companies, and ours is true also, you see, well, we did, you know, a series of raises privately. You know, we made progress over the years. We did a partnership with a pharma company. We took the company public. You know, you see a sort of a steady stream of events. But, you know, in the background, the reality is, you know, that you know, things don't go according to plan. You've got to be constantly adjusting and, you know, rejiggering the plan and being willing and able to persevere through things that sometimes are very – or through events that sometimes are very challenging. I mean, for us, the luckiest thing was, you know, turning over that data card for the phase two study that it was positive.
Yeah.
You know, and we were able to carry forward.
Both through your work with bio and emerging mm-hmm. companies, your own experience, mm-hmm. If you were to have advice for people who are starting mm-hmm. companies today, you know, what would that advice be?
Well, there's kind of generic advice and specific advice, right? You know, the generic advice, I think, which is always true, is, you know, work with the best people you can. And that's one thing I observed when I was at NEA, too. You know, they would be talking, I observed partners talking with other partners about deals. And, you know, it'd be sort of, well, what's the deal? Or, you know, what's the concept here? And then the first critical question is, well, who are the people?
Yeah.
Who are doing this deal? So I think people are you know, absolutely critical. And you know, again, this sounds simple, but you need excellent science and you need to really follow where that leads you. When we first started looking at the selectins as a biological target, sickle cell was not on our radar screen. But we continued to explore and do more studies and, you know, followed that there was, I think there's a good business reason for sickle cell, but there was a very strong biological rationale, similar to what we're doing now in cancer. Mm-hmm. I think we have continued to study the role that the selectins play, particularly in the cancer microenvironment in the bone marrow, for example, and the data has really continued to be very exciting. So follow the science.
The way you've described your mm-hmm. your path, your career path, there's something to be said for you know, the sort of tenacity that you've shown. Like mm-hmm. you're going in, this is where I want to work, and I'm going to go in there, whether there's a position for me or not, and sort mm-hmm. of offer my services until, you know, that position is almost available, or you mm-hmm. grow into the position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, perseverance. I mean, so if someone is, certainly if someone is trying to find a job in biotechnology, yeah, you're going to have to knock on a lot of doors, I think. You know, most people have to knock on a lot of doors. I mean, we had one case where I remember we were doing one of our raises, and we were at a venture fund, and we had a terrible meeting. We just had a terrible meeting at this fund. And we walked out, and one of the people on our team said, well, you know what they say, you got to meet with 40 people before you get one yes. So the good news is, you know, 39 to go, right? Only 39 to go. But so, yeah, tenacity is certainly important. And I mean, in so many respects, because, again, things often don't go according to plans.
What are the few things, if you can come up with any, that you feel like the industry needs to do to progress? Mm-hmm. As far as I'm considering things like policy and addressing mm-hmm. the public.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of things that we need to do. You know, I think one of the biggest issues that we're going to need to solve, I think, as a society, is how to ensure that we can continue to develop these innovative therapies and that people get access to them.
Yeah.
And we saw just coming out of this week's ASCO meeting the discussion about pricing, which
right.
I think is just getting more and more acute. And what can we do as an industry through policy and through our own work to continue to streamline clinical trials and drug development. And you see some of this effort now in the 21st Century Cures Bill that's working its way through Congress and some of the things we do with PDUFA negotiations. What can we do to streamline that so that we can hopefully rationalize the cost to develop drugs, which hopefully would be reflected to some degree in pricing? You know, we also have the challenge of defining, describing the value of drugs. You know, we like to make the case that drugs are priced for their value. I think the challenge we have, frankly, is that in a business where the, you know, from an economic standpoint, the demand curve, so to speak, is not elastic. You know, we have almost infinite demand for life-saving therapies because we appropriately value human life so much.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't have the normal pricing pressures that you have if you're selling, you know, bicycles or something. So we have to find ways to, and at the same time, our system can't afford to have expensive drug layered on expensive drug. So we have to find ways to address those issues. We do have a very successful, generic industry in this country, and so generics here are actually cheaper than they are other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So that part of the system works. But I think to work through those development issues and the access issues, I think it's going to be really key.
Let me put this out there. When you talk about this industry versus other industries, mm-hmm. for example, selling bikes, If a customer sees a bike that they want, mm-hmm. they consider the price and they buy the bicycle or not. Mm-hmm. If a customer, and I'm, you know, a patient being a customer, came across a drug that they needed and saw the price without insurance involved, they wouldn't buy the product. They couldn't mm-hmm. afford the product.
Right.
And it's one of the few industries where that actually operates in this way. Do you think that it's sort of inherently broken because it's built that way?
Well, it's insurance. I mean, that's so what you're describing is the insurance model, right?
Yeah.
And so I mean, I still believe in the insurance model because, you know, we all pay a little bit so that some don't have to pay a lot,
right?
So I do believe in the insurance model. So I don't think it's that per se that's broken, but I think, we're going to have to probably address this from a number of different perspectives. This is fundamentally such a different business than others, because of the potential impact that we have on human life and on quality of life, and it's I think that's what makes it such a privilege to work in, because we do have that potential, and I think that also speaks to some of the passion that a lot of us bring to it as we do this work. But that also brings special challenges in terms of solving these issues of access. So I think, you know, I don't know what exactly the answer is going to be. I know we're addressing it from a number of different perspectives. But I think, you know, most of us, if not all of us working in the industry, I think passionately want to develop the drugs and also passionately want people to have access to them.
Do you have kids?
Yes, we do.
How many?
Two.
And do you have chickens?
No chickens.
You're not doing that for them?
No.
How old are the kids?
Actually, children are both not children anymore. Our son is 27 and our daughter's 25.
What do they do?
Well, our daughter teaches second grade in a charter school in North Carolina. And And so she's working very hard with in a very challenging educational environment with
the Youth of America.
Needful kids. Mm-hmm. And our son actually did just finish medical school, so he is in the sciences, so to speak, and about to start a residency in orthopedic surgery.
Oh, fun. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the end of this podcast and the end of this studio. The usual round of thanks. Thanks to Rachel King for her time. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of this music. Thank you to listeners. It's my most sincere thanks, I think. And that's it. I will talk to you guys on the next one. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.